This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. The preceding portion of the California Report in the evening news has been brought to you by the Greenwood Community Center, celebrating the great day, August 25th, in Elk. And coming up is Education Now, which is brought to you in part by ARM members and SoulFest August 18th and 19th at the Solar Living Institute in Hopland. Alice Walker, Amy Goodman, and other guest speakers. Music from Dar Williams, Bruce Cockburn, and more. Schedule, lineup, and tickets at soulfest.org or 744-2017. Well, welcome, welcome. I'm Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. Tonight on Education Now, we're going to be focusing on teaching history, and specifically with an emphasis on women and girls in American education, and we're going to be looking at Sarah Lawrence and why there had to be a Sarah Lawrence. And we'll look at Joseph Campbell and C.G. Jung in this regard as well. I'm very excited to be bringing you this program. It's something I promised to do, and things just keep coming up. I keep getting suggestions from all of you about things to do, and I follow them up because they seem more important. So, first of all, we're going to have some music, and this music is going to lead us into our conversation about history. Here we go.
Corners on earth, I have stars. I place them upon back. And I was killed by that hatred of others.
Homo Sapien by Mark Escalera and Anthony Melville, who is one of the producers of this show, as he is president of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. And I felt that that was a perfect song for our discussion tonight about teaching history, and specifically the history of girls and education of girls and women in America, why there had to be a Sarah Lawrence. Well, good evening. I'm Athena Melville, and this is Education Now. And first of all, Homo sapien, yes, when we look at human history, how far back are we going to go? Are we going to go back just 2,500 years of Western history? Or are we going to go back to the very beginning of the hunter-gatherer societies who wandered and followed flocks and gathered plants, knew the plants, knew what they could do for the body, knew they didn't have large families, you know, the hunter-gatherers, because they knew how to prevent pregnancy. And I don't even know if it's legal for me to tell you the name of the plant over the air. But and of course, they lived longer. We know now they lived longer than agricultural societies with the introduction of grains. People lived didn't live as long, and with an agrarian, in an agrarian culture. So we have something indeed to learn from a history that goes back further than 2,500 years, and especially in the life of women, as we'll talk about as we go along. One of the things, when I think about just the topic of teaching, teaching is a caring profession. It's, you know, the social services, teaching, nursing, physicians. These are all part of the caring profession. And I want you to think about the bottom line and the way that we look at it now, and ask yourself if that's caring. If that's caring. Now, when you have, in a caring profession, emotions are allowed. I know that when I first was in at university, majoring in drama and speech pathology, I was told that I couldn't be emotionally involved in the students, and that was, I became very discouraged and dropped out of that field, and because I didn't know about Sarah Lawrence at that time, or I would have realized that it was just me speaking like any woman. How can you take caring out of a caring profession and call it a caring profession? Of course, in ordinary language, you couldn't do that. And what we think about as a high culture is something, or I should say most people in many textbooks, they think about the Renaissance as a high point in our culture. And of course, to Jung, C.G. Jung, and to William Blake, this view was just ridiculous, because what was happening with the invention of the towns at that time was, in the countryside, they were burning women as witches, and they would start the fire with a person who was gay, and they would call it a faggot, as they would start the fires. These women were being burned partially because the church wanted their property, and partially because they had that ancient wisdom and they could inherit property. We still had a commons at that time. Of course, with the hunter-gatherers, everything was a commons. The concept of owning the earth, or possessing the plants, or possessing animals, that was really foreign. It was all alive and spiritual, and life fed upon life, and that was an accepted, but there was a reverence for all of it, and a feeling that the life was giving itself to you, as you would someday give your life back to the earth. And of course, the earth is an ancient symbol of the feminine, and Mother Earth, and the body. It's also a symbol of the body. And so when you think about what Victorian culture and the Renaissance and their views about sexuality and the human body, then you can see just how deep this erosion of what was once called the sacred feminine when we listened to Joseph Campbell, just how deep that erosion went. It's also important, I wanted to talk about how a view of women and the earth is, how women were being educated at that time in America, and what happened before Sarah Lawrence, the way that women and girls were being educated in America. Women, girls were asked to sit for long periods of time, and because girls are very good at listening to and following directions, and when I say girls, I know that there are anomalies, that not all girls do, but by and large, the majority of girls are very good at listening to and following directions, so they would sit for a very long time, and they could only go to the bathroom at certain times, and we did a great deal of damage to bladders and cause lots of yeast infections from this practice, because you should be able to go to the bathroom when you need to go to the bathroom. But beyond that, we didn't really feel that girls needed to be educated in the math and the sciences. They were, especially in Europe, this view prevailed that women should learn how to sew and cook and read and play music and sing, but they shouldn't tackle any of the really difficult subjects. That was really up to men. Now, in Russia, during Jung's time, this was not the case. Many Russian women, especially women who were Jewish, were getting very well educated in the sciences and mathematics, and there were conflicts that they were dealing with. They would come to see Jung. One of these women was named Sabina Spilrin, who was probably the first person to put into words Jung's view of the psyche or the unconscious. And I want to read to you exactly what Spilrin says. Just a moment, I'm going to get that. What Spilrin says, this is her quote: "A symbol seems to me to owe its origin to the striving of a complex for disillusion in the common totality of thought. The complex is thus robbed of its personal quality. This tendency towards disillusion or transformation of every individual complex is the mainspring of poetry, painting, and every form of art." And that is very important because what we've learned is that art is prophetic. Art sees the future. A science fiction, especially, which is art, there have been many people who have drawn that parallel, said, look how science fiction, writing these writings before the discoveries. And this is something that Jung had said and that Spilrin had said, that once all of these conflicts of the individual are resolved, then when psyche speaks, and that's what Jung calls the unconscious, is the psyche. When psyche speaks, psyche sees the future. And so it's really quite beautiful, and it's sad that we haven't drawn those connections together in a better way. He himself, on his deathbed, Jung, had a dream about the earth and the devastation, and it was put in a drawer to be forgotten because it was very depressing to many people. And a little later I'm going to be playing, you'll hear Jung in his own words, and you'll hear his secretary also at the end, and you'll also hear Joseph Campbell speak. Because Joseph Campbell was the person who ended up teaching at Sarah Lawrence, and one of the things he said was that at that time it was a woman's college, and he was saying women in this country, they don't want to go to school and be told that they have to think like a man in order to get an education. They want to keep the caring and the asking the why and how it's all connected and seeing the whole picture. And Joseph Campbell respected that. he respected that goal of women, and it has filtered down somewhat. There are many women's studies classes that are offered in degrees in women's studies, pardon me, at other universities now, but really Sarah Lawrence was the first college to offer classes in women's studies, and and they had that great tutor, Joseph Campbell, who he and Jung, I would say, gave us more in understanding our own selves in time and space and through our mythology, because we can't really be separated from our mythology and be whole. And we can't really talk about history without talking about science. Because if you're going to talk about hunter-gatherers and that society, and you're going to talk about evolution isn't just a subject you can talk about in science. You have to talk about it in history as well, because we are constantly evolving, or you might say we stagnate, or some of us do. And yet there are people who do continue, even in those times of stagnation, to speak their minds. And one of those people who was always very famous with many, many women was a gentleman named D.H. Lawrence, who wrote a wonderful book called Women in Love. Now, if you keep in mind that the body is thought of as a feminine, just like the earth, then this quote from D.H. Lawrence might help you understand, especially in terms of sexuality. And in his foreword, D.H. says, "Let us hesitate no longer to announce that the sensual passions and mysteries are equally sacred with the spiritual mysteries and passions. Who would deny it anymore? The only thing unbearable is the degradation, the prostitution of the living mysteries in us. Let us only approach our own self with a deep respect, even reverence, for all that the creative soul, the God mystery within us, puts forth. Then we shall all be sound and free. Lewdness is hateful because it impairs our integrity and our proud being. The creative, spontaneous soul sends forth its promptings of desire and aspiration in us. These promptings are our true fate, which is our business to fulfill, a fate dictated from outside, from theory, or from circumstance, is a false fate." So D.H. Lawrence, as mixed up as he might have been, really was speaking for women a long time ago. He had a very short life and wrote so much, and died of tuberculosis when he was 45 years old. Jung lived a bit longer. He lived to 65, and he also had quite a tragic life. He was very lonely. Yeah, spent a great deal of time in his imagination, and his mother was very troubled, and so he very early on developed a good relationship with his inner life, which really helped him stay on top of it all. And he did have a breakdown at one point. His family stayed close to him, but he really felt that psyche, his own psyche, and then the universal psyche brought him through all of that. Now, Campbell didn't have that. He of course was younger, and during the war, and he managed to make money by playing the saxophone, the jazz band, and actually got paid for it, and he saved that money so that he didn't have to take just any job when the time came. He retreated to the woods, where he wrote until this wonderful job came up at Sarah Lawrence, which he took in a flash, because he was dealing with this split in the human psyche of Western man, this shadow having so much power over Western man. And Jung once said, "The mind of man can create an Armageddon." Well, with all that we're finding out about neuroscience and the power of the mind even to affect our genes, which I'll be talking to you with in a couple of weeks, and we've touched on when we've had Dr. John on, the power of the mind can do amazing things, but it can also do devastating things, and we're seeing We're seeing that those devastating things raising its ugly head again, like we have in the past. But with hope and with consciousness, perhaps we'll avoid some of the pitfalls and rescue ourselves. I certainly hope so. And this earth, this beautiful earth, because we are part of the wild and we cannot live without the wild. Sarah Lawrence College is located in Yonkers or Bronxville, New York. It was founded as a women's college in 1926, and it has been fully coeducational since 1966. It's a small liberal arts college recognized for the creative and performing arts as an integral. They recognize that the creative and performing arts are integral to a total language arts education. It was founded by William Van Dusen Lawrence on the grounds of his estate and named in honor of his wife, Sarah Lawrence. It embodied the ideas from the progressive movement of the 1890s, especially Lawrence's view that the arts were a critical element in the social evolution of individuals and families, in developing private and public sensibilities, and in creating equal relations between men and women. His disappointment at the failure of education to encourage his daughter's interest in music led him to found the college and to music and the arts. Harold Taylor was president of the college from 1945 to 1959, and he was a friend of the educator and philosopher John Dewey. Taylor worked for education reform in the United States, using the success of Sarah Lawrence as an example of the possibilities of a personalized, modern, and rigorous approach to higher education. As early as 1938, students at Sarah Lawrence were volunteering in working class situations of Yonkers, New York, to help bring equality and educational opportunities to poor and minority citizens. During the McCarthy years, a number of Sarah Lawrence faculty were accused by the American Legion of being sympathizers to the Communist Party. Since that time, activism has played a central role in student life, with movements for civil rights and against the Vietnam War in the 60s, and the student faculty diversity in the 80s. Also in the 60s, students established an Upward Bound program for students from lower income and poverty areas to prepare for college. They have campuses now in London, England, in Oxford, England, in Paris, France, in Cantonia, Italy, in Florence, Italy, and in Havana, Cuba. At present, Sarah Lawrence is the only American college that completely disregards SAT scores in its admission process. Dr. Michelle Tolecki Myers, former president of Sarah Lawrence, said, quote, "We are a writing intensive school, and the information provided by SAT scores adds little to our ability to predict how a student in our college would do. It does, however, do much to bias admission in favor of those who could afford expensive coaching sessions." Theater outreach and child development were also very intense at Sarah Lawrence. The Empowerment of Teachers Program, the Community Writers Program, the Office of Community Partnerships, and the Fulbright High School Writing Program are among the programs that provide services for the larger community started by Sarah Lawrence in the 70s. Students have remained active in recent years with numerous organizations and movements sprouting up in response to the Iraq War. In its many years, it has been considered as being at the vanguard of the sexual rights movement. Now, how does it work? Well, there's a core with a seminar of 1 to 15, and then a 1 to 1. No exams, there are research papers and essays. It is home to the nation's oldest graduate program in women's history. And it they call their faculty advisors who lead these seminars of 1 to 15 and do the one-on-one dons rather than teachers. I know that Alice Walker attended Sarah Lawrence. Well, if we go back to history, as far back as we go, and I wanted to, shall we look at ourselves then as primates and Homo sapiens or as mammals? Now, I've looked at other mammals and I've thought, is caring only something that is part of human history? But there's research about baboons in Nature that came out in 2002. And a woman who lived with the baboons until they accepted her as one of them. And she said soon, you know, their individual personalities and their individual traits came up, and she could distinguish all of them. And that once a week, they would all go climb to this lake. And they would sit around the lake in silence for 30 minutes. Now, that doesn't seem like that seems like a very spiritual behavior for a bunch of baboons in the wild. A lot of research on elephants in the wild and how they mourn their dead. They go back to the burial grounds and they paw the bones of the dead elephants, and almost like they're in mourning, and how they adopt younger elephants if the mother is killed or dies, and make them that younger elephant part of the tribe, and how the female elephant chooses the mate she wants, and then she'll prance around him until he chases her. But the females are choosing. That made me think of Nikos Katsenzakis when he has Zorba the Greek say, there's one sin that God will not forgive, when a woman calls a man to her bed and he will not come. So the educational what happened in education in America was that those women who accepted that they would have to leave their caring and their emotions at home did quite well. And you might say they even did, a lot of them, better than some of the men. But for those who refused, there had to be a school like Sarah Lawrence. It's no accident that breastfeeding became something that just wasn't done. It was something that, you know, and especially that you didn't do in public. And then when women started to do it again in the 60s, you know, like it was an important bonding activity, you saw a great deal of difference in the relationship in the family. And it's with the invention of the town is actually what happened in Europe. With the invention of the town, the baby was taken away from the mother and given to a nanny, because the woman had to be involved in the social life and in preparation of the family, not with the baby. And so for years then, the baby was not bonding with the mother. And there's so much about, you know, what happened to those particular women and their ability then to feel and to respond and to get, and to have caring relationships. Now, this caring isn't just a woman's story. Of course, men care, and men are capable of caring. But when they're told that caring is not masculine, that's when we have all kinds of problems in our culture. And we've tried to address that. We've tried and tried to address that with some success. But still, you see name calling when men show their feelings, when they cry or show their caring. The motto at Sarah Lawrence is wisdom with understanding, and wisdom is, of course, Sophia. Now, I can't help, I want to bring mythology into this again when I talk about the separation of nature from the human person and how women have resisted this, and many of them have not had the opportunity, of course, to resist. But there, the telling of the Arthurian legend and the Knights of the Round Table, when Arthur is in the wasteland and everything has been taken from him and Parzival is searching for the Grail. And when Parzival finds the Grail and he comes back and he talks to Arthur, he tells Arthur that what he has forgotten is you and the land are one. And this, it seems to me, is what we as a Western culture have forgotten. We and the land are one. One with the plants, one with the animals, and one with all of that life. And that's a part of the timeline of human history that we need to account for when we do history and when we talk history. One thing we do know is that when you tell the children the truth, all kinds of things happen. There's no need to shield children from the truth. So we've talked about nature and the earth and the body symbolically all being thought of as feminine, and feeling as thought of as a feminine function, and intuition a feminine function, while as where thinking and sensation are thought of more as masculine functions. But as a whole human being, it's important that thinking and feeling and sensing and intuiting, that all of those are operative in the human being so that they can go through all of the stages of evolution necessary to come to a kind of consciousness where there's a caring about everyone. Now, this isn't to deny the individual. Ego consciousness, which was relegated, really just males were able to have ego consciousness in the Eastern world, and for in the Western world for a long time, men were the only ones who had ego consciousness. Women went from childhood and early adulthood, they were back into a collective consciousness. They didn't develop the individual I. And in Eastern cultures, some people in the society, all males, developed that individual I. But women in those cultures stayed with a more collective consciousness. Once a person is goes into ego consciousness or develops the ego or the I, which is an important stage that should not be missed. I know that a lot of people feel that all of our problems would be solved if we just didn't have ego consciousness, but that's a necessary step. It's a necessary step so that when you enter collective consciousness and you think of the whole of humanity, and you see yourself as one with all of the plants and all of the animals and all of life, that it's not because you haven't seen it from the ego perspective. One of the fascinating things about art is that Rhoda Kellogg, whom I've talked to you about before, who wrote a wonderful book called The Psychology of Children's Art, what she found is that at a certain stage in every child's development, if they aren't blocked, they will draw this circle quartered by the cross. They will give it different names. They may do it in different colors, but they all draw it. And that symbol, that circle quartered by the cross, is also a symbol that Jung talks about as being part of every primitive culture. That circle quartered by the cross. And of course, that's a compass. It's the four directions. It's amazing. The other thing that Western history will teach us or tell us is that that the primitive peoples didn't know that the Earth was round, that Columbus was the first one to come to the continent of the Americas, but because we have found cocaine in the mummies, we know there had to be travel between the continents way before Columbus, because cocaine is not a plant that exists in Egypt and in Africa. And so this, all of this research and all of this information is not integrated into most of the textbooks in history. This is very important, and this is why I think it's essential that a person does their own history and their own research going to the original texts. Well, I've been blabbering for quite some time. I'm going to give you a little bit of music, and then I'm going to, actually it's a long piece, but then I'm going to open the lines. And the lines here are 895-2448 if you're local, or 1-800-499-7117. But first we're going to hear this compilation, and I hope that you will enjoy it. I'll keep talking to you while I key it up here. I hope I've got it on. I think it's going to come up here. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. I hope you enjoy this.
You have nominated people that think that they can turn back the clock. You thought we were asleep, but we came out in the cold today. We came out in the rain today. We came out in inclement weather today to tell you we don't care how cold it gets, how wet it gets. We're not going to let you turn us around. It was cold in Birmingham jails. It was wet on the bridge in Selma. But just like our daddies and mamas stood up, we're here today to stand up, and we won't sit down until we turn America around.
It's a corrupt, vicious, hypocritical system that has castrated the black man, and the only way the black man can get back at it is to strike it in the only way he knows how.
Justice is not just a struggle for blacks. It's a struggle for all of us.
It's a corrupt, vicious, hypocritical system that has castrated the black man, and the only way the black man can get back at it is to strike it in the only way he knows how.
The election of George Bush.
If we're wrong, why don't you arrest us?
Why don't you get out in front of the camera and go on?
It doesn't try to matter being in front of the camera. It's a matter of facing your sheriff and facing your judge. We're willing to be beaten for democracy, and you misuse democracy in the street. You beat people bloody in order that they will not have the privilege to vote. You beat me in the side and then hide your blows.
It's time for us to say to these men that if you don't do something about it, we will have no alternative but to engage in broader and more drastic forms of civil disobedience in order to bring the attention of the nation to this whole issue in Selma, Alabama.
And to keep in mind that social change rarely occurs because of an overwhelming mass participation. It usually has to do with the courageous critical mass who are willing to put the issues before the larger public, and the larger public then has to respond.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
When we look at modern man, we have to face the fact that modern man suffers from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to his scientific and technological abundance. We've learned to fly the air like birds. We've learned to swim the seas like fish. And yet we haven't learned to walk the earth as brothers and sisters.
Everything you can think of, everything you can see, is the production of the goddess.
A character is already there. This child is not born tabula rasa, as one assumes. The child is born as a high complexity with existing determinants that never waver through the whole life. And that gives the child his character already in the earliest childhood. A mother recognizes the an individuality of her child.
A ritual can be defined as an enactment of a myth. By participating in a good, sound ritual, you are actually experiencing a mythological life. Our way of thinking in the West, largely, is that God is the source of the energy. The way in most Oriental thinking, and I think most what we call primitive thinking also is, that God is the manifestation of the energy, not the source.
The world hangs on a thin thread, and that is the psyche of man. Nowadays, we are not threatened by elementary catastrophes. There is no such thing as an age problem. That is all man's doing.
Yeah.
We are the great danger. Psyche is the great danger. What if something goes wrong with the psyche? What if something goes wrong with the psyche?
But the beauty of all the life is to think that billions and billions and billions of years of evolution to build up the plants and the animals, the whole beauty of nature, that man would go out of sheer shadow foolishness and destroy it all.
All over this world, they're looking for us to stand up. Those that are victims of a foreign policy that gives one debt and another loan. Those that are sitting somewhere now, inhaling toxic waste because they put dumps in our communities and don't put them in other communities, and put the queen of racial profiling over the Environmental Protection Agency. They're depending on us. Those that sit on death row that are not guilty of any crime other than standing up for their rights, they're depending on us. They want to know why we're here. We're here because Mumia would be here, but he's locked up on death row. We're here for the martyrs that shed their blood, and we're not going home until we let the world know that we will not be turned around. Well, I come in the front of the Mani Temple to tell you there'll be a battle between the Christian right and the right Christians. The right Christians stand up for public funding for education. The right Christians stand up for women to have self-determination over their own bodies. The right Christians stand up for those that are down trying to be uplifted. The right Christians stand up against racial profiling, against police brutality. The right Christians stand up against thievery at the ballot box. The right Christians stand up against mergers of big corporations at the expense of workers and laborers. The right Christians will stand up in the name of Martin Luther King, in the name of Fannie Lou Hamer, in the name of Alan Lowenstein, and say we didn't come this far to turn around now. Will stand up in the name of Martin Luther King, in the name of Fannie Lou Hamer, in the name of Alan Lowenstein, and say we didn't come this far to turn around now.
Where love rules, there is no will to power. C.G. Jung.
The child should love everything that he learns, for his mental and emotional growth are linked. Whatever is presented to him must be made beautiful and clear, striking his imagination. Once this love has been kindled, all problems confronting the educationalist will disappear. Maria Montessori.
Nothing splendid has ever been achieved except by those who dared believe that something inside them was superior to circumstance. Bruce Barton.
It is possible to conceive a universal movement for human reconstruction that follows a single path. Its sole aim is to help man to preserve his balance, his psychic health, and build up a secure orientation in the present conditions of our outer world. This movement is not limited to any one nation, nor to any political particular trend, because it aims at the simple realization of human values, and that is what is of primary interest over and above all political or national differences. Maria Montessori.
I was not born a genius. I was just less damaged than other children. Buckminster Fuller.
There are two ways of spreading light: to be the candle or the mirror that reflects it. Edith Wharton.
Well, there you have it. That is our compilation of current history with quotes from C.G. Jung, from Joseph Campbell, Maria Montessori, Buckminster Fuller, and many others, hoping that we can get our psychic life as a Western world together so that we will not be destroying our land, our water, our air, killing the animals and the plants that we all depend on, that we're all connected, and that has to be the basis of teaching history if we're not to devolve into more chaos. Well, the lines are open here at 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117 if you have some words for me. If not, I want to tell you a few things. The homeschooling conference is happening this weekend, the 17th, 18th, and 19th in Sacramento. The AMS conference, the American Montessori Conference, is happening October 12th, 13th, and 14th. I'll be bringing you back some juicy pieces from that. Where Will the Children Play? A PBS documentary from the Alliance for Childhood will be on this fall. Please check your schedules. It should be wonderful. And check out the AllianceForChildhood.org for current and critical information about children and childhood education. On August 29th, Education Now will air again. That's in 2 weeks, and we're going to welcome Dr. Dawson Church, author of The Genie in Our Genes, and I hope you'll join me for that show. In September, the giant in epistemology, David Elkind, will be my guest. He's just written a book, The Power of Play, and I am so excited to have David Elkind on the show. My contact information is hermes@pacific.net. That's H-E-R-M-E-S @pacific.net. And you can listen to this show, which will be posted on my website, and all the other shows that have been on Education Now by going to www.pacificsites, P-A-C-I-F-I-C-S-I-T-E-S, .com/tilde, and that tilde up on the keyboard on the upper part of the right hand side looks kind of like Mona Lisa's smile. That's what the tilde looks like, in case you're wondering. And in October, hopefully, we're going to have Richard Love, Lost Child of the Wild, who is going to be at the AMS conference, and I'm very excited to bring you that, The Last Child of the Wild. I wanted to tell you that the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens is having a storytelling on Saturday, August 18th at 1 p.m. At the Meadow Lawn. Robin Fitzpatrick is one of our local storytellers, and she will be providing fun and interesting stories for all ages. The phone number is 964-4352, and the contact name is Karen Clayton. So, and that's on the calendar, but it sounds very exciting to me, so I hope that you will check it out. And tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, you can catch Karen Ottoboni on Hot Flash. That should be in a very exciting show. And Fridays are always wonderful on KZYX. And see, I think so much of it is all wonderful myself. I also wanted to tell you that the Mendocino Solid Waste Management Agency is having a Hazmobile collection Friday and Saturday, August 17th and 18th at 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Willits Corporation Yard on 380 East Commercial Street. Toxic waste that can't go in the trash is accepted at the Hazmobile collection, including paint, solvents, fuels, oil, fluorescent tubes, and other items. Household waste accepted without charge, up to 15 gallons per day. So there's that. Well, I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. I want to thank Anthony and Mark for that compilation and all of their team that got it together for us. And I also want to thank the Solar Living Institute for the giving us the preceding portion of Education Now. Soulfest, August 18th and 19th at the Solar Living Institute in Hopland, brought you this program, and I hope that you'll all be able to attend and see Amy Goodman and Alice Walker. And right now, David is here, and we're going to bring up Earth and Sky. It's just about 8 o'clock, and coming up is going to be Dave and his crew. They're going to be at the reality check. They're going to be giving you a variety show tonight. And then after that, of course, some wonderful Dead Air and on into the evening. Thank you so very much for listening and being with me tonight on Education Now. I look forward to hearing from all of you. Bye now. Here's Earth and Sky.
And Sky.
Legions of scientists are working on developing alternative fuel vehicles, cars that can run on biofuels, solar, hydrogen, or electric power.
And some of these cars are already on the road, but when will there be enough alternative fuel vehicles on the road to make a big impact on emissions?
Not anytime soon, according to Jeroen Struben, a postdoctoral associate at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's co-author of a recent study that asked what it would take for consumers to move away from fossil fuel-powered cars.
Struben told Earth and Sky that the challenges of alternative fuel vehicles go beyond technology. He created a model that analyzed auto consumer behavior and what he called the physics of replacement. For consumers to decide to buy an alternative fuel vehicle, he said, the entire industry will have to mobilize.
For example, automakers will not invest in alternative fuel.